This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, Tee Shiao Ik. It's our first public health show for the year. So, as always for the public health series, we have Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO for Galen Center, CEO of Galen Center for Health and Social Policy in the studio. Good afternoon, Azrul. How are you today?
Very well, Shao Yi. I think I got over the flu just a couple of weeks ago. So feeling much better.
It's sweeping through, and so many people just around the office are either down with it or recovering from it. Within your circle of friends, you...
Yeah, definitely. And I heard you came down with it too. So.
Yes, I'm just recovering from it myself. we'll actually be talking about influenza on our show this Friday. So all of you should tune in for that because there's so much confusion just about, you know, vaccination.
Yeah. Should you get vaccinated or not?
That's right. Yeah. Is it the same thing as the antiviral medication? Yeah. Is it the same thing as a cold and all that? So yeah, so that one will be Friday at 4 o'clock. But for today, we are talking about, healthcare workers. We're talking about healthcare professionals, really the people in the front lines when we're talking about any sort of health issue at all. So, I mean, last year, 2019, kind of ended on a note of uncertainty for many workers in the health sector who had been told that the government was actually considering stopping the critical service incentive allowance. And this would cover quite a number of professions in the civil service. And for the health sector, it would have included medical officers, pharmacists, dentists, and nurses. For the new ones joining the service from 1st of January 2020, that was earlier this year. So, you know, that bit of news and the fact that the government then said that they were deferring that decision sort of ended a year that had been filled with quite a number of ups and downs for medical professionals. So today we'll be discussing the implications of some of those policy announcements affecting healthcare workers in Malaysia. So joining us to have that conversation is Dr. Vicky Neshwaran Sivasubramaniam, Chairman of the Malaysian Medics International, or MMI. How are you today, Dr. Vicky?
Hello, Michelle. I'm actually starting to get the flu from yesterday.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. There we
different
go.
Levels. Different levels. Can hear that sexy voice there.
Oh, yeah. And contagious. What are you doing here? right. If you have any questions or thoughts that you'd like to share about healthcare practice in Malaysia, you can call us 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So I think because this is the first show of the year, it would be good to sort of do a stock take of how the Ministry of Health did last year. There was so... Actually, I was... I mean, in a way, pleasantly surprised. There were lots of very bold moves taken by the Ministry of Health, lots of policy announcements, some quite unexpected, but some sort of like things that have been on the table already, you know. So if we look at you, Vicky, how would you score the Ministry of Health performance last year?
Right. For me, I believe that Ministry of Health actually has two big overlying functions. So they do look into health, but they also look into illness. Mm-hmm. So Ministry of Health reads for sick people, and they also look into prevention. Mm. So on the preventive side, I believe that the Ministry of Health has done pretty well. They came up with a ban in smoking. Mm-hmm. That was pretty good on the wellness side, the health side. Yeah. I would easily give it an 8 out of 10, I guess, I'd say.
Yeah.
I was previously not. No much emphasis was given from the previous governments and all that on health and wellness, on preventive measures.
Yeah.
We were not doing much on that.
Yeah.
But with the current government, we did give some emphasis to that, and that's great. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when it comes to the illness part, I don't know. I did not really see much happening there, and that's a small concern for me. I'd probably score it 4 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were many changes happening on the illness side with the healthcare professionals. So that was rather concerning for me.
What do you think, Azrul?
Well, I think it was, as you said, quite an eventful year for a lot of bold and, I would argue, courageous intents and announcements made by the Ministry of Health. I think it shows a very clear commitment of the Pakatan Harapan government to introduce wide sweeping reforms to the healthcare system, meaning it's not business as usual. I give you an example concerning the liberalisation of essential services. I think we all heard about the Farmaniaga discussion where they have basically been told that their dominance over the drug government drug supply is going to be coming to an end, and it'll be an open tender beginning next 2 years or so, and it gives time for everybody to prepare, and something that we can all look forward to. There was a lot of emphasis on dealing with the unjust situation for GPs and people working in the private sector, where you have their fees been frozen for 27 years, and now rather than adjusting to something that was agreed to several years back, they've totally gotten rid of it. And
this is deregulation
of the fees. So there's a lot more, it seems, to come, especially with the discussion of digital health, more investment in that area, where it's looking towards something that can catapult Malaysian healthcare into the next 10 or 20 years on par with developed country healthcare system. So I think 2019 ended, if I were to give a grade, it would be better than the grade we gave last year. I would give it a B minus.
Okay. Yeah. You know, Vicky, you talked about sort of two broad approaches, right? Preventive care and then sort of the curative aspect, I suppose,
that's right.
Dealing with disease trends. But what about when it came to medical practice? Issues, problems, challenges, specifically for healthcare workers and related to your standards of practice and things like that. How did 2019 fare for medical professionals in Malaysia?
There were a lot of sudden changes brought up or announced. Mm-hmm. Many have not come into action yet. I felt that might have just, you know, triggered the system a little, because we have been rather complacent. We've been doing things at a certain way for a really long time now. And yeah, it has been working well. So when we want to bring in new changes, I'm sure there will be some people who might not be too happy about it. And we are waiting to see how these changes would take effect. So, for instance, when it comes to the medical profession, previously, doctors all had a secure job. So you know that when you become a doctor, your life is pretty much set. So you'd have a good job, good pay and all that. 2 years ago, that changed when we introduced the contract system for the new doctors. And then we thought that some of the doctors would be absorbed for permanent placement and some would not. And then last year, what happened was that the Ministry of Health said doctors probably would not, the junior doctors probably would not get a promotion. So from 41, they would not go up to 43, which means there won't be a raise in salary, a bigger raise in salary when you go up a grade from house officer when you become a medical officer. So that sort of triggered many doctors because, number one, pay is a little bit affected. And also, you know, we are used to a really hierarchical structure. So juniors, house officer 41, medical officer 43, and then you become a consultant. The hierarchy has always existed. So now that when we try to break the hierarchy and say that, despite being a house officer or medical officer, you're the same level, many people are not too happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
But that changed, right? Because after that, the Ministry of Health announced that they will approve 43?
The cabinet approved, but the Ministry of Health is still discussing with the Finance Ministry and GPA.
I see.
We do not have any confirmation on that yet.
I see.
Yeah, so that is still pending.
I mean, you know, for us, I think we see doctors, if we are talking about doctors being one of, you know, the healthcare professionals we're discussing today, we see doctors as providing a life-saving service. We don't think of them as human beings who need a salary, who need to, I don't know,
that's
support families.
True.
That's right. I mean, doctors get sick too. I get viral influenza too.
That's right. He's a doctor. Yeah.
But this is a very important point to emphasize, because people in this country, I would argue, take health for granted, or more accurately, take health services for granted. Mm. They look at it that it needs to be welfare. It needs to be free. It needs to be something that you don't have to really think about paying for. And the reality is that that pay goes towards funding those essential services. So the moment we look at it differently, in this way, looking at it discounting the funding that goes towards ensuring that these services are able to be funded, then you're discounting the quality of healthcare itself. You're compromising that. And this is where we need to change our own mindset, I think, when it comes to health. But can I just say that when this news broke on Christmas Eve,
mm-hmm.
That the Bantuan Incentive Perkhidmatan Critical, or BIPK...
No, it was on Christmas Eve.
It was Christmas it? Eve that it broke, and Code Blue, the health news portal, actually broke the piece of news, and nobody actually knew what was going on, but just to say that it affected, or if it would affect, more than just the healthcare profession.
Mm-hmm.
It would affect people in public service who are architects, engineers, and even air traffic controllers. So at the end of the day, when you look at it, this is a bigger issue than just the doctors, pharmacists under the healthcare sector, but also how we look at what we call Perkhidmatan matang critical.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would ask a basic question, perhaps for Dr. Vicky. How does VIPK factor into your life as a junior doctor? Because I think a lot of people don't understand. I mean, so it's $750.
Mm-hmm. What's that in the bigger picture of things?
What is that for a young doctor? I mean, perhaps you could
Before we go into that, I realized that there was actually some miscommunication with the definition itself. How the public or healthcare professional perceived critical allowance and how the civil service department defined critical allowance was different. And up till Christmas Eve, I was actually not aware of that. I assumed that the critical allowance was given because of the nature of my job, where I technically put myself at danger as a frontline when I deal with patients. I assumed that was why the critical allowance was given.
Mm.
On the other hand, civil service department was giving it because previously they did not have enough staffs to fill the role. So this allowance was an incentive to attract and keep staffs,
mm.
which is what that was given. And I honestly was not aware of it until now.
Okay.
So that was the first issue. People, misdefinition, miscommunication were there. So people assumed that because of the nature of my job, I deserve to get the allowance. So many of the healthcare providers felt that, which I do not think it's wrong. We do a difficult job.
Mm-hmm.
So as a doctor, my starting salary is about 2,900 ringgit. That's pretty good.
In the government service, correct. Yeah?
But when it comes to the staffs who are below me, nurses, medical assistants and all that, they do not get that starting salary. So the 750 ringgit actually makes up, you know, close 15 to 20% of the salary.
Yeah.
Is this.
Yeah.
So when you take that away, it makes a significant difference. For instance, if you're paying rent, if you have children, this money makes a big difference.
Yeah. We'll come back and discuss more about that. Also, the idea, like you said, because originally it was introduced as a way to incentivize people to enter these. Now we understand that it means these are critical service sectors, probably, or critical professions. And so if we are talking about rationalizing the need for that allowance, are these professions still considered sort of critical in that sense? I know, Azro, you did say, yes, they provide critical service, but, you know, then where's that? Why is that disconnect, you know, in terms of taking away that incentive for people? This is our public health show today. We are talking about the issues facing health workers. We're looking at some issues that came up last year and what we hope to see being discussed this year. Azro Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy in the studio, as well as Dr. Vicky Siva Subramaniam, Chairman of Malaysian Medics International. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. It's our public health show today, and we are talking about some critical issues facing health workers and healthcare professionals here in Malaysia. We have Azro Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, as well as Dr. Vicky Siva Subramaniam, Chairman of Malaysian Medics International, otherwise known as MMI. We're discussing, I think, especially pertinent because Vicky is here with us, it's sort of the issues facing younger doctors and healthcare workers coming into the profession today, and really how they can cope with not just the work issues, but how they can support themselves in this economic climate today and things like that. So that's very much a critical issue because we're talking about the critical service incentive payment, also known by its Bahasa short term BIPK. So what happened on Christmas Eve last year was that the government made the announcement that they were going to abolish this payment for several professionals joining the civil service beginning of this year. And so this would have covered medical officers, pharmacists, nurses, but also other professions like engineers, architects, I understand, even, was it air traffic controllers?
Air traffic controllers, yeah.
Yeah. And so Vicky, you mentioned earlier that JPA's reasoning for it, for introducing it, Back in 1992, was as a measure to incentivize people to take up positions in these critical sectors, which were understaffed at the time. And it is a significant amount, especially for those in the lower pay grades, you know, the medical officers and nurses, for instance, for whom this would be, say, 15 to 20% of their monthly salary. But Vicky, is the healthcare sector still a sector that needs incentives for people to join it?
To be honest, no. I think the healthcare sector will still attract people because very often many people are passionate about it and they might still join.
Mm-hmm.
But keeping them is another question. It's not about just having the staffs, but, you know, looking into staff's well-being. It is not just about developing the infrastructure, but if you do not have the manpower, the people to run it, the infrastructure fails.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about retention.
Retention, that's right. Yeah. And this matters a lot. So in our country, we do not have enough specialists, if you notice. So the number is very, very low. Although we produce a significant number of doctors, specialists, touch a cope still.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a major concern for me. I feel that the Ministry of Health should be looking into ways to progress into that, to produce more specialists for the country. You know, when you have more specialists, the quality and service of care that they give will improve tremendously. Our specialists are being overworked. For instance, my center, when it comes to blood vessel diseases, my center, my hospital is the National Referral Center. So I get referrals from Sabah, Sarawak, all the way to here. So if we produce more vascular surgeons and they are placed all across the country, the quality of service will improve tremendously. Patients will be more happy. And in order to do this, we need to look into the well-being of our staffs, the manpower. I believe is the biggest asset for the Ministry of Health. It is not about having records. It is not about having huge, wonderful operation theatres and robots. Because at the end of the day, when it comes to healthcare, it is the people touch matters a lot. And, you know, these small incentives may not seem big, but, you know, carrot and stick. So you've taken away the carrot. So deep down, there might be a small pinch there. And when you're giving service, so you might feel a little bit, you know, upset. You don't feel appreciated, and that's a little bit sad.
This is a very important angle to emphasize, because I have a colleague who is a pharmacist. And when I asked her about this issue, she said very clearly that the BIPK helped to compensate for the off-shift hours that they take beyond their allocated time in which they're supposed to be doing work. Because at the end of the day, you can't allow the large number of people waiting outside to be deprived of services. So you voluntarily do that work, and then you're doing a lot more than what you're supposed to do. Mm. And this BIPK incentive allows them to feel compensated for the little bit more work that they're doing, so that they don't begrudge the system. And you're exactly right, Dr. Vicky. You know, you feel appreciated at the end of the day. And the problem here is that once you take that away, then it leaves this feeling possibly of resentment and disgruntlement of their contribution to the healthcare system to be, I would argue, unappreciated. And the problem here is, I think we look back at the nature of VIPK. GPA stated very clearly in its announcement, in its letter, that this was supposed to be temporary. And this is like 2 decades later, it's become sort of entitlement, and it's basically arguably permanent. So it's
and
no
it's
longer
supposed
incentive.
To be reviewed, you know, periodically. But well, apparently, this particular review has just come out with a decision to abolish it. But you know, if in its nominally at least, it's not. You don't need it in that form anymore to serve that purpose of incentivizing people, let's say, to join a critical sector. But if you say that some form of
incentive,
some form of appreciation is still needed, some sort of compensation, what should that look like if the BIPK were to be abolished?
It should be an allowance still. Okay, for instance, with doctors. So house officers have this thing called flexi allowance. So that is to cover for the on-call that we do. Sure. Medical officers get 200 ringgit per on-call that they do, whereas house officers, the pay is pretty fixed, you get 600 ringgit, which we technically lose when we become medical officers. So now that I'm an MO, my salary is 600 ringgit lesser.
Okay.
Really?
So, yeah. Lesser. Yeah. So if I don't do enough on-calls, I'm not going to get adequate salary.
Of course.
Right? So if the Ministry of Health can come up with this sort of flexi allowances for house officers, perhaps they can look into ways into doing likewise for the future healthcare professionals. Come up with healthcare critical allowances.
But I would argue, and because we're talking about the healthcare system overall, not just doctors, can the same model be applied to pharmacists, for example?
Why not? They also take in contract. Nurses, dentists, pharmacists.
And nurses as well?
No. Dentists, pharmacists and doctors. The contract started at the same time for all these three groups. So why not?
Yeah, because nurses are also affected by this as well.
Yes, that's right.
So this is going to be the tricky, challenging part of whatever that's going to come out from this compromise concerning BIPK, is that whatever deal that is worked out for doctors, young doctors or young pharmacists, must also be applied to nurses as well, yes, hospital assistants, because they are all part of the same recipient beneficiaries of BIPK.
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be a solution, unfortunately, in this case, that needs to fit all the different categories of people here, because at the end of the day, they are also affected by the VIPK issue.
And I mean, one of the biggest, I think, strains that healthcare workers, especially in the public health sector, face is that they are overworked, obviously underpaid. They're working overly long hours in overcrowded public hospitals and healthcare facilities, right? So, I mean, if we are only looking at a small amount of this compensation every month in the hopes that this will make them feel appreciated, isn't that very short-term?
You're absolutely right. Actually is a fair point. Very short-term measure. Perhaps they can look into other ways, increase the salary or improve the quality of work. Yeah, the long working hours are there, staffs are being overstretched, underpaid. So we know that the ministry is having issues with that. Underpaid. Okay, fine. Overworked. Can we do something about that? And yeah.
But let's be honest here. Mm-hmm. This was supposed to be a temporary measure, as you said, to incentivize people to join critical sectors that needed filling up in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
2 decades later, we're now in 2020, and that allowance is still going on. Arguably, however that we are very uncomfortable about it, honestly, there needs to be a review of the current way in which the government is incentivizing or providing assistance to these critical sectors. Maybe VIPK is no longer needed because a much more permanent solution is actually needed. And perhaps that is what is needing to be announced by the government, where it looks at a much more sustainable solution. Because at the end of the day, this VIPK was meant to be a temporary stopgap measure.
Mm-hmm.
And the government giveth, the government taketh away. Yeah. So in this case, they reserve the right to take it away.
Yeah, I mean, and in this case, it's JPA, Public Service Department. And you know, is there a disconnect there then between JPA perhaps not seeing clearly or understanding the needs of healthcare services?
I think there is a serious gap there. In the statement that JP released, they state that the number of jobs allocated for nurses is 222. I do not know whether that was an error or that was intentional. 222. My hospital has 3 times the number of nurses.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot be working with the number. It doesn't make sense. So every year we set up new hospitals, but we're not increasing the manpower. So up to last year, last year they've allocated 10,000 jobs, which is great, thank you very much. But there was a freeze in the jobs previously. So when we set up new hospitals, staffs were being moved elsewhere. So
instead of hiring
That's
new.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that is how staffs end up with being overworked.
It takes a while to actually get to the level of capacity that you expect efficiency to occur.
I think there should be more transparency from the Ministry of Health side in releasing data or information on health capacity, human resource needs. I honestly do not know where to find statistics on that. Mr. Ajul, do you know anything about that?
Well, I can tell you what the Ministry of Health has actually been upfront about.
Mm-hmm.
And the audit report that's been shared numerous times again and again has indicated that the Ministry of Health public healthcare facilities are understaffed. How much of it is understaffed? You have to look at the audit report.
Mm-hmm.
But with the increase and the commitment by the government to actually increase the capacity of health workers, and you just said just now 10,000, it's great because it shows that the government wants to address the understaffed issue. But the problem here is how do we get to that ramp-up level where we're able to have all these positions filled, but also at the level and expertise and capacity that we need. And I don't think we're necessarily there, because right now we have a lot of positions that continue to be unfilled, but also there is a drain, a movement from public healthcare to private healthcare, which is also occurring at the same time.
Mm.
And I think the VIPK issue is not going to help matters. I think it will actually cause perhaps people to be demotivated and move to the private sector.
Tie that in with the deregulation of the fees.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's just going to move. That's what I feel that's going to happen. But, you know, none of these have actually come into place yet. So I don't know. But I feel that people might be doing that. Why would you want to stay at a place where you're overworked and underpaid when there's an opportunity for you to still serve the people, do some good, and make better money and have better quality of life?
Hmm.
So why would someone, you know, want to pick one over the other?
I mean, is that the main driving factor, salary, for the brain drain?
I don't think that. But again, that is my personal opinion. There are many factors that drive people into doing what they want to do. Some people... Money does matter up to a certain extent. So sometimes when you have families and all that, if you don't make enough money, you need to look into other ways to sustain your life. So,
well, it's a reality.
That's a reality, yeah. Yeah. You're right.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, another issue related to medical practice that came up last year, and this one was, I think, really took quite a lot of the quarters by surprise, was the Health Ministry tabling an amendment to the Poisons Act, which would potentially see them legislating patients' requests for drug prescriptions from their doctors. And essentially what this would mean is that it becomes mandatory for doctors to provide prescriptions upon request from patients, and if they actually don't provide those prescriptions, it is a punishable crime. There's a 3,000 ringgit fine or up to 1 year's imprisonment. What were your thoughts on that, Vicky, when that news came out?
Again, carrot and stick. There's a lot of stick coming up, but no much carrot. I personally feel that all doctors should provide prescription for their patients for whatever medications they give. Patients need to be aware, regardless.
Okay.
Of the if you're giving a medication, it is only fair that the patient knows what they're taking.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often in my center, I see that not happening. As in the public side, it is mandatory, so we do give. But sometimes when patients arrive to us, the white packet has no name on it.
So when you say prescription, mm-hmm. we are talking really about it's the labeling that states what medication you're getting, what dosage, what's the name of it. Is that right? As
That's
opposed
right.
to just doling out the pills in a plain packet.
That's right.
Without you understanding.
That's right.
I see. Okay.
But this is the thing that I would like to get a sense from you, Vicky. What is the status quo? Why is there a need for this legislation? Why do you think?
Yes. Is it supposed to address a problem where, across the board, patients are not getting proper prescriptions?
Yes.
I don't have much experience working in the private side. I have never done GP work and all that. But this happens quite often. We see patients coming in. They've been on long-term medications, hypertension, diabetes. The patient does not know what medication they are on. They go to private follow-up.
They remember the color of the pill.
Yeah, orange color pill, white color pill.
What red color pill.
Yeah. Yeah, so that does not help the patient at all. So patients need to be educated and they need record. Unfortunately, that is another issue in our country. Patients are not empowered, or patients do not have ownership of their own health details. Patients do not know what they don't know what medication they are on. They don't have copies of the records unless they go to private. So I don't totally agree to that.
But isn't that also a symptom of what I mentioned earlier about the complacency concerning health? People look at it that once you're going to the doctor, you place your health, yourself, in trust to the doctor who's supposed to be the guru, who's supposed to then help heal you. Therefore, you feel that you don't have a right to question or ask or get information or double check whatever the guru tells you. And therefore, this is actually an issue of trust, right? So they don't bother learning a little bit more about healthcare. So we're talking about health literacy. I mean, for them, I don't know anything. Why should I learn up more? I go to you because I want you to tell me what's going on. Why should I then find out and then second guess you, right? So this is the problem right now, right? Where we want patients to be much more informed of their rights, but also to know about their own health, right?
Yeah.
And where is Malaysia? I mean, compared to a developed country.
You're absolutely right. I think healthcare ownership matters. And I feel that with the newer generation, this is improving much better. So at least when you have children who are better educated, so they take the initiative to know about their parents. And that is extremely good. Great. Well done. So I guess with the lesser developed or when we go into rural sites, it's still very much lacking. But in Klang Valley, I'm seeing that that's getting much better. We're having, you know, more apps coming out. Very often I see patients showing their apps with details. And that is great. Really? That is good. That is good. Not many.
Dr. Google.
They have applications like iPhone has an option for them to record their health details. That is good. That is really useful.
Okay.
I would encourage all people to do that. But it's a slow work in progress. We are still a developing nation. I hope that this happens in the future. We have to ensure that patients have ownership and access to their own health details. This is one issue that always bothers me. Who owns the health data? So sometimes when you go into these applications and give, we do not know what happens to it.
Well, that definitely is a topic that's going to be discussed extensively over the next year or so, because electronic medical records, right, health data, digitalization of health is very vogue right now, especially for a lot of countries like Malaysia.
But coming back to the Poisons Act amendment, I am actually very confused about this, because I thought the issue was the fact that patients required certain medications that perhaps doctors were not prescribing. But it seems to be much more... It goes down to finer details than that. That patients may be prescribed, a particular kind of red pill. You know, previously they'd get 10 red pills over the course of a week in a plain packet. They don't know the name. And then if this amendment were to go through, doctors would land themselves in trouble if they were to do that, but they must give a script that states what is the... So what is... okay, then in that case, what's problematic about that then?
Well, again, this is just my opinion. I don't know what's happening. Generic medications, many centers that tend to use those generic medicines because they're cheaper than giving the original ones. So the generic medicines come in big bottles, so they can put and give. So that's why there's no label there. And yeah, I think that's why that happens.
Well, if you look at the way a doctor prescribes medication, by right, there needs to be a written prescription. You can't just issue medication. Mm-hmm. You have to prescribe, and the prescription is filled by a pharmacist.
That's right.
So basically, in any system where there's separation, this is what happens. The doctor prescribes, you bring your script, you go to a pharmacist, and then you get the prescription filled. Mm-hmm. In Malaysia, because we have integrated systems where it's in the same clinic, you know, where you can get your medication as well, the movement is 1 meter away, basically, you know, from the doctor who scribbles in his ineligible handwriting, passes it to the nurse who figures out whatever is being prescribed, and then the prescription is filled. Mm-hmm. So if we're moving to separation, we need to actually have a much more standardized, clearer, a more, I think, accountable way of doing things. And this is actually, in my opinion, a positive move towards ensuring that we are clear in terms of what is being prescribed.
But isn't it putting the cart before the horse? If we are not talking about a separation of dispensing rights yet, then why are we talking about this?
The conversation has got to start somewhere. And the problem here is that we can't wait for all the pieces to be in place for the discussion to happen. What I think was a little bit the cart before the horse situation was to legislate and provide for punitive action, like you were saying, Dr. Vicky, about the carrot and the stick. It's very hard to take out the stick and there's no carrot, you know, and the situation is not yet permissible for you to ensure that it actually happens. So some of the smaller clinics, for example, might find it hard to actually provide the facilities to be able to write out or print out the prescriptions that are needed. But patient education here is key. If you want a situation to improve, patients themselves, I believe, should be able to speak out and demand for that to happen. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're actually subcontracting that responsibility to the government to decide for us, to police, to regulate. And I think our part as patients, we have a right to be able to demand for accountability, which is what this comes from, you know, this place, the amendment. But therein lies, we need to have a discussion about the bill, patient bill of rights, you know, and this is part of it. You need to know what you've been prescribed. And sometimes doctors fear that because then the patient will then Google up. Now you, Dulu, you used to refer to this encyclopedia of medicine. I forgot what.
MIMS.
Yeah. Well, MIMS is one thing, but there's a book, you know, I forgot what the title.
Manual,
The manual, right?
Merck Guide of Drugs.
And then you go to that there and you see all the adverse reactions, side effects.
And then you come back and score your doctor.
And then you go to the doctor, you say like this. And now you don't have that manual anymore. You have
Google at your fingertips. Yeah.
So some doctors are concerned that rather than entrusting them with your health, you are now taking an active participation in it, which may or may not be beneficial for your well-being.
But, you know, nevertheless, like you said, jumping straight to legislation is the part that's problematic. Yeah, and, you know, along with that, if doctors as a professional group are not aware of the implications of certain practices, then that's not fair to them. Yeah. So, you know, consultation.
Exactly. Yeah, and adherence to that regulation, by the way, costs money.
Yes.
So for the smaller clinics, who's going to pay for adherence to or compliance to that regulation?
Yeah. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, consultation. I mean, that's always the biggest problem I think we face when it comes to making policies and making laws. Is there adequate consultation with all the necessary stakeholders in this process? It's our public health show today. So we're talking about issues that are facing healthcare professionals together with Azrul Mohammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, as well as Dr. Vicky Nishwaran Siva Subramaniam, Chairman of Malaysian Medics International. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-ik. It's our public health show. We're talking about sort of the year that's passed, 2019, that had quite a number of policy announcements that affected medical professionals in Malaysia. So in the studio to discuss that, Azrul Mohammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, as well as Dr. Vicky Siva Subramaniam, Chairman of Malaysian Medics International. We've covered the critical service incentive payment, or the BIPK. We've covered the Poisons Act amendment that could potentially see doctors being punished if they don't provide drug medication prescriptions to their patients. And I think that those are just two. And we're really just dipping our toe in the water with this discussion. That there's so much more affecting medical practice and standards of medical practice. But overall, what it seems to say to me, when you look at the reactions to these policy announcements, there's always a flurry of press releases and statements from particularly, let's say, the doctors groups like MMA, saying we were not consulted on this, we were not aware of this, this would have severe, far-reaching implications. Would you say, Vicky, that there's a lack of consultation with stakeholders?
I honestly think, yes, there is a lot of barriers there. So we saw many U-turns in policies to be announced. Then after people make noise, it gets postponed or get cancelled. I honestly think that should not happen. You know, one good thing is that at least some changes are happening. That is good. People are used to being, you know, complacent system, but nothing happened. Changes are happening. That is good. But sometimes it is good to discuss first with the stakeholders on how this change would affect the people before announcing it. And then it really doesn't reflect good when you announce something and then a few days later you have to cancel it or defer it. So that doesn't really reflect well on the people who are making the announcement. And then that can inevitably lead to us losing faith in the government. And that I'm very certain that's not what the government wants. I'm sure they're doing all these policies in goodwill for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that better stakeholder consultation would make things much, much, much better.
Mm.
You know, one of the things that all you have to do is look at the experience of Perkab 40 and Maisalam last year. the rollout was quite hurried. There was a lot of problems with both policies. And Booker B40, for example, has the ingredients of being one of the innovative programs that we've seen in years, and one that looks at the healthcare system not as two separate entities, but an integrated body where public and private sectors both work together, as it should be.
Yeah.
But because of the lack of consultation in some aspects of these programs, there was a lot of problems that resulted in a lot of time wasting in terms of arguments, negotiations, accusations of no consultation, and also fault finding, you know. And a lot of this could be avoided if a deliberate process of policy development, deliberate process of consultation in the policy development stage was invested in. I think because there wasn't enough of that, that perhaps there was a need to show something very quickly. These programs were rolled out in the time and the manner it was. But I think we need to stop doing things which was business as usual in the past, which was announced first, repair later, revise, change later. I think we should do it in a much more deliberate process, which is reflective of more mature democracies, which is you put in the time, invest in the consultation, invest in a rigorous policy process which involves stakeholders at every point, and then we're able to get to where we want. And most importantly, there is buy-in and ownership.
But perhaps it's because things can't move when you have endless rounds of consultation.
It's true, Shahid. I can tell you, policy consultation is a hassle. You will talk to people. People will argue. Nobody can get to the same page. People will dispute. You can't get everybody in consensus, but you can get people together or a majority forward. And that's important because you need buy-in and ownership of the policy later on. But I give you a recent example, which has caught everybody off guard, which is the announcement by the Minister of Health on Sihat Bersama 2030. Honestly, nobody I know has any idea what exactly is being presented to the cabinet at the end of this month. And that includes all the professional bodies that should know.
And this is the plan for health financing reform.
Yeah. And that is a major thing. After the traumatic process of OneCare that went through several years ago, we want to avoid that kind of situation again because we don't have many shots at reform in healthcare financing. We want to make sure it's done properly. So I would make a call that let's do it properly. Let's do it right. Let's have the consultation process, even though we really feel that it's such a hassle, a time, or you feel that it's taking too much time and energy. Let's just do it properly and get those changes done.
Just very quickly, Vicky, what do you think are some of the critical areas that you'd like to see the Ministry of Health focusing on for 2020 when it relates to improving medical practice?
As I said earlier on, so we have health and illness. So we have come up with some pretty good stuff, ideas for health. So smoking, let's make sure this goes on properly. We need to make sure it's properly monitored and implemented. So it might be good to look into other NCDs as well. So diabetes is in the rise, obesity, something for that might be good. But I think we should give more emphasis for illness because we are still struggling very much with that. Our hospitals are understaffed, so our facilities are not that great. Our manpower is not adequate. So illness needs a lot of improvement. And I hope that the Ministry of Health for this year at least will give more emphasis on illness. So illness may not be as commercial. Smoking, public all knows about it. So they can relate. So there's a lot of viralization. So people talk a lot about it. But when it comes to illness, when you talk about drugs for neglected illnesses, so not many people know about it. Not many people are affected. People don't talk about it. But this matters. So dealing with cancer, dealing with diseases, which rare diseases, all these matters. And I hope the Ministry of Health would give more focus for this as well for the upcoming year.
What do you think, Azrul? 2020?
2020 is going to be a big year. I predict there's going to be a lot of discussions concerning healthcare financing. I mean, but SB 2030 is just the start.
We'll need to see what Sihat Bersama 2030 looks like.
Of course, yeah. And there's going to be a lot of calls to ensure that the Ministry of Health stays the course, especially when it comes to the issue of the smoking ban. I think we need to lend support to the Ministry of Health, the Minister and the Deputy Minister of Health, to ensure that they are firm and committed to ensuring that our public spaces are free from smoking, but also to ensure that there is no confusion. Especially recently, there's been an announcement of smoking areas.
Designated smoking zones. Yeah.
So, you know, we need to avoid a situation where the public is confused. Is it smoking or not smoking? What exactly is... So the consultation process is very important. But I think also we are looking forward to the reforms that the government has committed to, especially with regards to the previous problems such as the hospital Sultanah Aminah fire, which occurred in 2016.
Where's the report on
that? I mean, I think we need to ensure that there is public accountability concerning that incident because lives were lost. And the minister has made a commitment to release the report last October. Until today, we still haven't seen the report. I think it's high time that in 2020, if we're talking about 2020 foresight, I think we need to look at hindsight and see what exactly went wrong, you know, in 2016, so we can avoid repeating those problems in the future. So a lot of things that we're looking forward to the reforms that the government is wanting to introduce, and hopefully we'll be able to stand with them in support of what they are committed to do.
Yeah, and you know, you can't talk about reforms if you don't have things like transparency, accountability, consultation. Yeah. Thank you very much for this conversation today. I've been speaking to Azrul Muhammad Khalid, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, as well as Dr. Vicky Nishwaran Siva Subramaniam, Chairman of Malaysian Medics International, MMI, talking about issues facing health workers in Malaysia today. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.